Shalom and welcome to the Israel Policy Pod. I'm Neri Zilber, a journalist based in Tel Aviv and a policy advisor to Israel Policy Forum. Our old friend Amos Harel, the defense analyst and correspondent at Haaretz, is back with us this week for a special wartime episode. We're going to be discussing October 7th and covering this Gaza war, the state of play of the IDF offensive, and what may come after, and at the end, Lebanon and the Northern Front. This is the last episode of 2023, and not a moment too soon. Looking back on everything that has happened these last 12 months, it's not just the atrocities and the tragedies of October 7th, and it's not just the 2.5 months of war in Gaza and on several other fronts. It's all of it, and everything that came before, including 9 months of domestic crisis and mass protests against the Israeli government's judicial overhaul gambit. Remember that? Seems like a lifetime ago. The hope, really, is that this terrible year, with all its upheaval, with all its bloodshed and loss of life, will lead all of us to something better in 2024. That's the hope, at least. Let's get to Amos Harel. Hi, Amos. Welcome back to the Israel Policy Pod.
Hi, Neri. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome back, Amos. It's been way too long and a lot to get into, obviously, given, well, everything going on in Israel these last 2.5 months. But I wanted to start here more on the personal side. You and I have spoken a lot since October 7th, but we haven't done it for, shall we say, public consumption on the record. I know you hate it when I say this, but you're one of Israel's most prominent defense analysts and correspondents. It's actually a much smaller group than people realize. So let's start here. If you could give us a sense, what was going through your mind on that Black Saturday, as it's come to be known here, October 7th? When did you personally realize this was something different? And what has your life been like in the 70 plus days since covering this war?
Look, I would have loved to have been a foreign journalist here. It's the most interesting story in the world. The only problem is that almost everybody I love on earth happens to live in this country and is going through the worst time in their lives during the last 75 days. So it's very interesting professionally, but I would have given quite a lot if we could have been saved from all of this. It's really a huge ordeal. And it goes to show perhaps even the limits of our imagination as professionals, as journalists, because, you know, I wrote about the military, I wrote about Israel's security apparatus, I wrote about our different security challenges for the last 26 years, mm-hmm. and even wrote quite a lot about possible pessimistic scenarios, had a lot of criticism regarding the IDF's conduct on different fronts and so on. But I never imagined something like this. Whenever I thought of a possible war, the worst case scenario was Hezbollah in Lebanon. And even then, I couldn't picture, I'd say, 30% of what actually materialized. So just like everybody else in Israel, I was taken by complete surprise on that Saturday morning. Woke up like everybody else at 6:30 in the morning from the sirens going all over almost everywhere in the country. And gradually came to realize within an hour or two that this was something completely different. The first signs were not only the sirens and the actual reporting from the Gaza border, but just text messages. Our good mutual friend, Amir mm-hmm. Tibon, who happens to live in Kibbutz Nachal Oz, texted me immediately. I think I texted back something like, this is big, stay at the safe room, don't dare to get out. And then within an hour, getting text messages from him that he hears gunshots inside the kibbutz, that he can hear Arabic near his home, then I realized that this was entirely different. And once you get those messages and start reading reports and seeing those awful videos from all over the place, what's known in Hebrew as the Gaza envelope, the different villages and towns along the Gaza border, you realize that this is a surprise attack, that we were taken by complete surprise, that the IDF is overwhelmed with the sheer numbers of Hamas terrorists crossing the border, and that this is going to end in a disaster. I think that by noon it was quite clear to everybody who has some experience watching this. And, you know, I still pinch myself twice or three times a day to realize that this is not a nightmare, that we're not dreaming. I went today to the Gaza border, spoke to a division commander there. We're all still in a state of shock, I think, the whole country. The IDF has recovered to a point. It's, of course, still busy with a massive ground operation in Gaza. The damage in Gaza, the number of deaths to both to Hamas members and to Gaza civilian population is perhaps 15 or 16 times higher than what we've encountered on our side. And yet, this hasn't helped improve the general feeling here. We're still at a huge national crisis, something that we haven't faced in the past. And all those cliches you've heard are true. This is the singular most catastrophic event for Jews and especially for civilians since the Holocaust. Not the same numbers, of course, thankfully. But this is devastating. This is devastating, and it will have huge implications for the country at large and for the region, I think, in the next few years.
Absolutely. And after that Saturday, after noon on that day, what has your life been like just covering this war as an Israeli military correspondent?
Of course, it's work almost 24/7. We don't get much sleep and we're busy covering the news all the time. Specifically in Haaretz, my role is to write at least once a day an analysis that's supposed to contain everything. I mean, all the recent developments and putting them into context and trying to explain the roads taken and not taken and where the war is heading. So it's quite a challenge, I think, to do that on a constantly on a daily basis for so long. And you get, you know, dozens and dozens of phone conversations and meetings with different sources. There are quite a lot of briefings from the IDF. I drive to the Gaza border two or three times a week. Also, every now and then visits to the northern border as well. So lots of work, but mostly it's not the burden of the actual work. It's the worry. It's the fact that people are sincerely troubled by what has happened and worried about the what's going to happen later on. And since it's Israel, it's also, I always say that there's only one degree of separation in Israel. Everybody knows everybody. And you know that this country, this society is extremely sensitive to human loss. Hamas sees things differently, of course. But here in Israel, whenever a soldier dies, this is a matter of national interest and sometimes national mourning. And here we have, of course, not only many, many soldiers who've died defending the country, but also a huge number of innocent civilians, mostly died on the first day, on the massacre of October 7th. So the general feeling is this huge sense of loss about every life being lost, and also concern about the outcome, especially for soldiers fighting now in Gaza. You know, there's this ritual in which at 5:55 a.m., the IDF spokesperson publishes some of the names of the soldiers who died the previous day. And like a lot of people, maybe it happens to you as well, I find myself waking up at 5:30, 5:40, waiting for that text message, which is terrible, but that's the way it goes right now, because this is the general feeling shared by a lot of people. And once you have acquaintances, relatives, and so on, who are sharing that burden of fighting there, it becomes almost a personal thing. Thankfully, I don't have a son or daughter fighting in Gaza now, but many of my relatives and good friends have them, and it's a matter of really constant worry. And it's something that we've experienced in the past. I've seen that ever since 82, the first war in Lebanon. But it's a country or a society traumatized by this experience. it also goes back to explain why Israel was so weary of massive ground incursion into Gaza, into Lebanon, and so on. We have avoided that for many, many years. Netanyahu's mistakes here were part of a sort of a national atmosphere. It wasn't only the prime minister who wanted to try to avoid that. But I think the sensitivity is still there. Just after the attack, the massacre, the IDF, in some ways, it's a bit cynical to phrase it this way, but saw this event as a license to kill and be killed, so to speak, meaning that they could use much more force against the Palestinians and also risk much more soldiers' lives because of what happened and because it seemed that in order to fight this absolute evil shown by Hamas, and this equation of Hamas equals ISIS is quite accurate in my view, then there was a huge public and national support for ground maneuvering into Gaza, even invading all of the Gaza Strip because of that. Yet, 2.5 months later, first of all, we'll probably get into that later, but we haven't won anything yet. There's no decisive victory over Hamas. And secondly, the casualties still hurt. It's something that we're still concerned about, and it affects everybody's feelings about the situation.
We will definitely get into the state of play in the war in just a moment. And you rightfully say that after October 7th, the pain tolerance, the pain threshold in terms of the Israeli public and casualties amongst the soldiers went up, because I suppose it was seen as both a justified war, a necessary war, and also a war of no choice, as they say here. Mm-hmm. But it still, like you said, very much brings pain every morning at 5:55. And I relay this anecdote to people, especially the foreign journalists, but also people on the outside looking in at everything happening here. The real recent moment that I think summed everything up was the funeral for Gadi Eisenkot's son, the mm-hmm. former chief of staff, and now a minister in the war cabinet. His son Gal was killed, I think, 2 weeks ago now. And Gal's funeral was carried live on all the TV channels that Friday afternoon. And Gadi Eisenkot gave a very heart-wrenching eulogy. Benny Gantz spoke, Netanyahu was there, but also Gal's siblings and good friends also spoke, and it was all carried live. And it was very, very difficult to watch, and I'm sure, like many others here in Israel, everyone watched it.
Yeah, I happened to attend the funeral and then went to the Shiva as well. Mm-hmm. I've known Eisenkot for 25 years, known and admired him, I have to say. And I think he's probably the only general I sort of have become friendly with during the years. And when we went to the Shiva, Gadi being Gadi, he's so personal, and you know, there's nothing, he doesn't carry himself like a minister of the war cabinet or a former chief of staff. So he sees us there and he walks towards me, and then he says, "You probably don't remember that, but the first book you wrote with Avi Sakharov, which is a book we wrote about the Second Intifada a long, long time ago," he said, "I'm quoted in the next to last paragraph." And I said, "Really? I don't happen to remember right now." He said, "Yeah, I have a copy of the book and I checked it this morning in our family library." And it turns out that we quote him there, it's 2004, and he was then the division commander for the IDF forces in the West Bank. And he's quoted as saying that the fight against Palestinian terrorism would go on for many, many more years, and that his youngest son, age 5 at that time, would probably participate in that war. So, you know, that was quite devastating to hear from the grieving father.
Absolutely. And it's incredible, Amos, because I read it in your column that you ended that column, I think last week or maybe mm-hmm. the week before, right after the funeral, with that anecdote. But I didn't know it was Eisenkot that reminded you of that anecdote. Yeah. So he remembered it and he mentioned it to you, not the other way around.
Yeah, and that's typical. Gadi Isaac got a perfect memory, and something very personal about the way he, you know, expresses his feelings. And I've heard so many stories about that in recent days. If you have time, I'll mention another one. When he spent some time at the Washington Institute after he finished his military service. So again, a mutual friend, David Makovsky, introduced him to a bunch of soldiers, what we call lone soldiers, people who either made Aliyah from the U.S. or came here to spend some time and serve in the army. And of course, Gadi had dinner with them and spoke to them, and they were all excited because he was an ex-chief of staff. And then one of these kids came back to Miluim, to reserve duty, at the beginning of the war, and died at the Mount Dov area, if I'm not mistaken, at one of the first incidents with Hezbollah. And Makovsky told him that this was a guy from Herzliya, from Gadi's hometown. So Eisenkot went to their shiva almost every day of the next week. And now that kid is buried next to Eisenkot's son's Gal at the, you know, at the cemetery, at the military cemetery in Herzliya. It's a small country, as I said.
Very small country, and a very unique individual, Gadi Isaacson. Almost final question in terms of your coverage and your work, and it kind of relates to the personal nature of everything going on here and also your work. In a lot of your columns and arts, you've often written about the criticism you have with regard to how the Israeli media covers the war. Sometimes certain commentators and journalists seem more concerned with boosting national morale than with, you know, actual coverage, you know, even actual coverage that the public may not want to hear. So how do you personally balance that tension between being a journalist covering this war, professional, and, like you said, being an Israeli and covering this very, very personal event that's still ongoing?
So this is personal to me as well. I'm not pretending that I'm come from somewhere far away and I can judge this objectively. I'm an Israeli citizen. As I said, my friends and family members serve in the army. I used to serve in the army myself for many years as a reservist in a combat unit. So I feel for the country and I want its success. I'm, of course, very, very critical of some of the IDF's conduct during the years, and I'm terribly critical of the current government and especially the man in charge of Benjamin Netanyahu. But other than that, I don't pretend to be objective. Having said that, I don't think that our job right now is to mislead the public and to tell them that, yes, within a day or two, Hamas would crumble under the pressure. Because, I don't know, you're probably watching the news as much as I do, Channel 12 and so on. And sometimes when you turn on the TV at 8 o'clock in the evening, what you hear there are, you know, almost celebration parties of how we almost won this, or we're about to win this, how this is going to turn a corner soon. And anybody reading their history, whether it's Vietnam or our wars in Lebanon, or wars I covered myself, the second war in Lebanon, the second Intifada and so on, the different operations in Gaza during the years, we all know that it's much more complicated than that, and that we should remain critical. So this is one big problem. I think we don't have to scare the public. We should be careful and cautious about what we write, what we publish under these circumstances. You don't want to frighten everybody. And sometimes the news is quite bad. You need to explain the context and so on. But to mislead our readers or our people watching TV or listening to the radio and so on is even it's even worse as a crime, as a professional crime, so to speak. This is my view. The second issue is that because things are so terrible here, what you have 10 times larger than what we've experienced in the past is an absolute refusal to discuss the pain and suffering on the other side. Now, again, I have to admit it, as an Israeli, going through this ordeal, I've lost most of my empathy for the Gazans. And I think that many of them were collaborating, whether willingly or unwillingly, with the Hamas regime. And we saw many Gaza residents joining as a mob, joining that terrible massacre on October 7th. So I don't think that everybody in Gaza is innocent. And in my view, from a moral perspective, I'm not saying serves them right, but I am saying, well, this is something that Hamas initiated, and we had no alternative but to storm into Gaza and fight back and try to force a deal with the hostages, and even in the end, try to defeat Hamas. We'll see if this actually happens that way. But I think that the Israeli war is justified. And under these circumstances, I have less patience, so to speak, for Palestinian suffering than I've had in the past. Having said all that, I do think that we need to present this so people realize what's going on the other side. And I think that the, in a way, our TV channels and many of our newspapers, and Haaretz is the exception, are treating the Israeli public as if they were kids, as if they can't know about this because it would hurt their feelings or something. The fact that, you know, that the airstrikes are killing many innocent civilians and so on. I think we should know about that. I think we should know about the damage and destruction to Gaza buildings. It's not something to be proud of or to be happy of. It's part of the consequences of fighting a very difficult war against a terrorist organization that's hiding behind its own civilians and using them as human shields intentionally. And I think that Yahya Sinwar, somewhere underground in the tunnels, probably under Khan Yunis, doesn't give a damn about his own people being killed by the thousands. And yet, as Israelis, I think we have an obligation to understand what's going on and to figure this into our calculations of what the next steps should be and so on. It's not a good service to the Israeli readership to avoid those issues completely, even though it's you know, sometimes uncomfortable to read about this or watch this.
Right. And I know you and I have spoken about this before, so we've had this conversation as well about the mood and the coverage here in Israel during the war. And I happen to agree with you on all those points, as we have discussed before. And I always come back to the notion that the level of self-criticism and self-reflection inside Israel, at least in some parts, Haaretz and others, maybe the exception these days, it's so much greater than the self-criticism, self-reflection exhibited by the other side about their own leaders and their own politics.
There's hardly any self-reflection on the Palestinian side. No. It's quite amazing. I think part of the huge problems of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian society is this absolute lack of self-criticism and the tendency to blame Israel or the international community for everything that happens to Palestinians.
Right, when this was a purposeful and very deliberate attack by Hamas, led by Sinwar and the others. Done the way it was done. They're not idiots. They calibrate everything very carefully. By the way, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the three hostages in the video released last night by the Hamas military wing. One of them is Chaim Peri. I've gotten to know his son Leo Peri a bit these past few weeks, just covering the hostage ordeal through the eyes of the families. And Chaim Peri is 79 years old. From the Nir Oz kibbutz.
He's the youngest of the three, I think. Yeah.
He's the youngest of the three. This man, when they talk about peace activists, this man used to drive Gazans from the Erez checkpoint into hospitals in Israel and the West Bank on his own time as a volunteer. This man, there are videos that I've seen of him arguing with settlers on the Gaza border ahead of the disengagement in 2005, yelling at them, saying, "We have to leave Gaza. We have to tear down those settlements and leave Gaza." And look, this is the man being held captive by Hamas in an underground tunnel right now, inside Gaza.
Even without getting into the political crisis and the different political opinions in Israel, I think it's quite clear anybody who's visited those kibbutzim at the Gaza envelope area has noticed that these are the nicest people around, the best kind of Israelis, liberal, well-meaning, nice, friendly, smart. This was the atmosphere in all those kibbutzim. And I always ask myself during the previous rounds of violence that were, in retrospect, nothing to what we've experienced now. How do they come back living there time after time, considering their experiences, considering all those rockets, considering the tunnels discovered, and considering the fact that quite a few people died during the years? It's those same kibbutzim, and yet they came back. The real Zionists, in my view. And this was not an occupied territory. This was not about oppressing the poor Palestinians. This is Israeli land since 48. But then again, not in the eyes of Hamas. It's quite clear. What's so frustrating as an Israeli is how quickly the experiences of October 7th were either forgotten or denied or pushed aside by so many among the Western left movements everywhere around the West. Just, you know, either denying that this ever happened or praising Hamas for what they did, or just saying that, you know, that this doesn't justify, that Israel was not proportional in its response and so on. Hardly any understanding for our case. This is even more infuriating than the actual event, the fact that you cannot explain yourself, that you have such a hard time. And I have to admit that, you know, in the beginning I appeared on CNN and so on. I have less time and patience right now. But whenever I'm asked, for instance, by the BBC, I feel I need better English to actually deal with them. I'm not a Hasbara guy, you know. I'm not really busy defending the country's case at all costs. But I just, this, you know, there's this satirical show, Eretz Ne'ederet. How should we translate it? What a marvelous country. Wonderful country, yeah, whatever.
A wonderful country. It's like the Israeli Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, and they had quite a few sketches in which they were extremely poignant about this double standard by the Western media and the Western left regarding Israel. You know, joking about Harvard on the one hand or the BBC on the other. I think they had three or four of these sketches. And usually I'm not too happy about these when they're done in English. They seem to me, you know, so blunt, too blunt, and sometimes heavy-handed and patriotic. But this time they got it right, time after time after time. This exactly pointing out this double standard used by the West when dealing with Israel. And again, I don't think that you can compare it to anything. Maybe 9/11. But even that, if you just compare the sheer numbers, considering that we are only 9.5 million people, what we've experienced, and by our numerical standards, so to speak, was 10 times bigger than what the U.S. experienced in 9/11.
Yep, the equivalent of 30,000 people.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And by the way, just to tie up this section, Amos, by the way, we could go on talking about these issues for another 30 minutes, but in terms of Chaim Peri and the 2005 disengagement, you remember probably better than I do that Ariel Sharon, when he was trying to persuade and sell the disengagement to the Israeli public, said, well, we're going to leave, but if there's any in future security issue out of the Gaza Strip, we'll have a lot more international legitimacy to go back in and act. That was one plank of his argument for the disengagement. And now Israel has zero legitimacy, it seems like.
To some extent, he was right about this, because Operation Cast Lead, which was the first major operation, and that happened under the Olmert government in late 2008, if you remember, at the end of that operation, I think there were five Western leaders who came here as support for Israel, even under circumstances in which we killed many Palestinian civilians and so on. But the sympathy, a certain kind of sympathy, was still there. But one could argue, I still think that the disengagement was the right thing to do under the circumstances of 2004, 2005. But one could argue that Sharon himself, by deciding not to act when Hamas launched rockets at Israel, I think about a month after disengagement, these were the seeds of what happened now. Israel hesitated so many times, and we gave ourselves so many explanations on why we shouldn't fight back, or why we shouldn't be too aggressive, or why we should be careful with Hamas and so on. The end result, of course, is that now we have this monster of a terrorist entity just on our border, not 5,000 miles away. And that's a big deal. If you look at the, we'll probably discuss that later, but if you look at the those tunnels being discovered, and we knew, we were supposed to know about the tunnels, we wrote about them, we discovered some of them in the past, we published a lot of information, the IDF, the Israeli media, and so on. And yet what you realize right now is that at least in the last 12 years, since Yehi Sinwar was released from Israeli jail as part of the Shalit deal in 2011, these guys were building for, you know, preparing for a sort of a doomsday scenario, which was all their, something that they initiated. They were not busy spending money on founding youth orchestras in Khan Yunis or building tennis centers in Rafah. This was all about preparation for a sort of a doomsday scenario, a last battle against the Crusaders. And, you know, the tragedy from our point of view is that they were so successful, much more successful than anybody could have guessed. You know, this general I talked to on the Gaza border this morning, so he said, we prepared. Yes, we were, he said, we were not negligent. We spent all our time preparing, but we thought that at one point or another, there will be 30 or 40 terrorists attacking at two places by and taking us by surprise. He said, had you told me that there were 300 terrorists, I would have thought that you may have drunk too much alcohol the day before. But 3,000? You know, it wasn't in the cards. It wasn't something, this is part of the, of course, the terrible, what we call the concept, the terrible fiasco of military and Shin Bet intelligence. But this, you know, what we face in the end is a tsunami, and this is why it overtook the IDF, and this is why they were able to be so, you know, this massacre was such a murderous success in the end.
Right. Right. Okay, we'll be right back after this brief message.
2 months since the horrific Hamas terrorist attacks on October 7th, the immense challenges ahead are still coming into focus. Our policy, community, and next-generation leaders are on the front lines in an increasingly hostile, complex, and polarized moment. They need our support, and we need yours. Our policy analysts are providing nuanced insight, commentary, and information to help policymakers, community leaders, and others understand and navigate the challenges of this ongoing crisis. Our community engagement is in overdrive, with constant educational programming for communities and organizations across North America, and an acceleration of our IPF fatigue programming for young professionals and students on college campuses. Our social media posts are reaching tens of thousands of viewers, with nuanced analysis and insights as an essential alternative to slogans and misinformation. We need your support to sustain this work. Please consider making a gift today to ensure that we can continue to be a source of credible analysis and constructive ideas. Donate now at ipf.li/supportthepod or at the Support the Show link in the show notes.
Amos, we have to shift to current events and get down to the brass tacks, which I'm sure our listeners are really keen to hear from you about the state of play of the actual campaign in Gaza. 74 days into the war, we're recording this on Tuesday night Tel Aviv time and also Hod HaSharon time. What do you think? How close, in your estimation, is the IDF to achieving the goals as they've laid it out, destroying Hamas as a military and governing force in the Gaza Strip and returning the remaining hostages, over 100 hostages?
Again, insisting on not being a cheerleader, unfortunately, we're not close yet.
Sober-minded.
Mm-hmm. It will take time. I'm not sure we'll have all the time. I think, again, that the negotiations or the discussions between the Israelis and the Americans would probably lead a change of phase in this Israeli strategy within 2, 3, or 4 weeks. This is what we'll see. And the war would change its texture, its nature. It won't end, but it will be a different war. And it will take a lot more time to actually defeat Hamas. We're talking of degrading Hamas right now, but a final victory, if it's in the cards at all, this will take time. Now, going back and trying to analyze the results so far, yes, the IDF has been extremely successful at operating in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, at killing, according to their numbers, and one should always be weary of body counts, According to the IDF's numbers, they assess that they killed more than 7,000 Hamas terrorists, which is somewhere between a quarter and a third of Hamas's fighting force. About half of their battalions are now in a very problematic state. They can hardly operate. And many of their military commanders are dead. And also, you know, the IDF has managed to destroy a lot of their assets. And if you look at it from a rather cynical, strategic point of view, the fact that Israel has driven out almost all of the civilian population from the northern part of the Gaza Strip, that's quite a cost to pay for the Palestinians. That's a huge price for the Palestinian people of Gaza. A second Nakba, if you'd like, a second disaster. Perhaps not as bad as the one in 48. But again, northern Gaza Strip is destroyed. It will have to be rebuilt, and it will take years and years if somebody allows this to happen and if somebody is willing to put the money,
to
invest the money to pay for it. So these are very massive losses for the Palestinian side. And yet, they don't mean that Hamas is going to wave white flags anytime soon. They're not going to surrender. Again, because Yehia Sinwar sees this in messianic terms, in ideological, deeply ideological and religious terms. He sees himself as a sort of a new Salah ad-Din fighting the current crusaders, meaning the Zionists. And he's willing to pay almost any price in order to achieve what he wants. Now, if you read those articles published in the New York Times and Washington Post and The Guardian about a month after the war started, it's quite clear that this is what Hamas was up to. Hamas leaders in Beirut and in Qatar telling those foreign journalists that this is what they wanted. They wanted to stop the Israeli-Saudi normalization deal. They wanted to change the regional discussion completely. And they wanted to hijack the Palestinian movement or the Palestinian struggle against Israel and to dictate a very different agenda, not an agenda of possible peace process like we hope to have, some of us hope to have, of the Palestinian Authority, but a constant fight going on, which would be more and more costly for Israel. And of course, they were quite successful at that. The end result is not so helpful from the Palestinian side because they paid so much. But yet, they are hanging in there. They remain in their tunnels. While Israel is in control of northern Gaza above ground, the underground is something completely different. And now there are attempts to occupy the area of Khan Yunis, which is south of the center of the Strip. Mm-hmm. And presumably Sinwar and other military leaders are hiding there underground. And yet we still need to try and assassinate those people. We still need to try and release the hostages. And it's assumed that Sinwar has taken many of these hostages as a personal insurance policy. So he's surrounded himself by not only by innocent Palestinian civilians, but by kidnapped Israeli civilians and soldiers as well. So this is, this is extremely complicated for us to reach a decisive victory. And the question remains, how do you change phases and still continue the war and still hope to get your goals? One of the problems is that Netanyahu and others have set the bar, raised the bar so high in the beginning. The goals being defied, the expectations of the public and so on. And we could see a scenario in which the public is devastated by the results, meaning you told us that you would defeat and destroy Hamas completely. You said annihilate Hamas. It hasn't been achieved. Many soldiers' lives are lost. We were willing to risk our lives or our families, family members' lives in order to get this done once and for all. And yet neither Netanyahu or the army are able to deliver this at this time. And on the other hand, there are a lot of expectations from Israel to somehow move forward. So the Americans are expecting a change of phase, moving to what we call phase three, meaning redeployment of most of the forces out of the Gaza Strip, holding some kind of a security perimeter around Gaza on the Palestinian side, let's say a mile or a mile and a half inside the Gaza Strip. perhaps still avoiding, preventing Palestinians to come back to the northern part. And on top of everything else, continuing incursions into Gaza, but not using huge divisions, but choosing to use brigade forces. Something a bit similar to what happened in the West Bank after the Defensive Shield operation in 2002. And what the IDF keeps reminding us is, look, we Defensive Shield happened on April of 2002. That was after the Passover massacre and after many, many months of terrible suicide bombings inside Israel. We defeated the Palestinians there, but it took us two or three more years until we finally managed to stabilize the situation in the West Bank. And we're saying we can do the same. In Gaza, we need the stamina. We need the public to show patience and so on. Is that possible? Hard to tell. On top of everything else, one of the problems is, of course, that Netanyahu is refusing to discuss the day after. And, of course, he's trying to prevent any Palestinian Authority footprint in Gaza, which makes it even more difficult. If you had a clear, a clear strategic path forward, it would have been probably better and clearer. It would have been an easier way to define a victory on a battlefield, but he just refuses to deal with that completely.
Right, for his own domestic political purposes, mm-hmm. planning exactly. his own day after the war. Amos, I want to touch on something you said about the transition from the current, what we call the high intensity phase. This is the second phase of the war to the third phase, which is a lower intensity, like you laid out. Do you think both militarily and also politically, let's say some point in January, right, 3-4 weeks from now, like you laid out, that the Israeli politicians and even the Israeli generals can come to the public and say, hey, we're shifting now into this next stage without actually, say, killing Sinwar and the other Hamas leaders and without securing the release of at least some more hostages and without actually putting a dent in the Hamas military machine? That, in other words, can you actually shift to that next stage and send in brigades if they're going to find the same resistance that the divisions are now finding inside Gaza?
Look, it's going to be hugely complicated to do because maybe the generals can live with that, but the politicians, and especially Netanyahu, will have a very hard time justifying this decision. Why? First of all, there will be criticism from the left. I'm generalizing here, but let's define this as left, the camp supporting another quick deal to release all of the hostages at all costs, even in return for the release of all Palestinian prisoners, including the murderers from the massacre of October 7th. So there's quite a lot of support, let's say, on the center-left for that, but it's impossible for Bibi to do because the right wing would kill him for this, not kill him physically, but would hate him and
politically,
and try to overturn him, overturn his government if he tries something like that. On the other hand, and again, I'm simplifying and generalizing here, the right wing would have a very, very hard time to accept a withdrawal from Gaza without reaching the goals, without defeating Hamas completely, without killing Sinwar and so on. So let's imagine that in a month's time, because the Americans are asking for this, because the generals, some of them are already recommending this, because there's too much of a burden on the Israeli economy, because so many people are still in uniform, the reservists and so on, Netanyahu feels the need, the strategic need to pull out of the Gaza and to move into the next phase, as you phrased it. What if he does that and then his government collapses? If Smotrich and Ben-Gvir decide that this is the right time to make this distinction between him and them, this could be the end of his career. And remember, he's much more anxious and desperate than any time in the past, because he's fighting for his, not only for his political survival, but he's trying to keep himself out of jail. And unfortunately, he's more worried about that than the better good for the Harel family or Neri Zilber and his friends. Okay, this is the reality right now. So politically, I don't know how this would evolve, but I think that at one point or another, he would try to initiate or even fake a crisis with the United States over this, saying, I'm the only defender of Israel, I'm the only one preventing Palestinian Authority presence in Gaza, and I will continue to fight. And this is doesn't seem to be, to me, like the right path to take. But again, politically, it may be his only way to maintain power. Then again, I have to admit that the other suggestion, the American suggestion, nobody's promising that this would actually be successful. What if those incursions don't work? What if Sinwar manages to maintain command and control for most of the Hamas battalions, and every now and then launches rockets? What if those all of those hostages remain in captivity, and many of them continue to die under those terrible conditions? This is, you know, from an Israeli point of view, this is still a complete nightmare scenario, and you somehow have to solve it. People like Eisenkot are saying, not publicly, but it's quite clear that they think enough is enough, that a change needs to be made, and that in order to maintain the military advantage, you need to change path and change the tactics, at least, if we want to secure a victory in the future.
Interesting. I think we can agree that the coming few weeks are going to be critical.
Mm-hmm. To the on the other hand, we've been saying that for the last 2 months. Yeah, yeah.
That's also true, right? The push into Gaza City and the hostage deal, right? Also very critical. Amos, final issue I wanted to raise with you, and it's a big one. It's Lebanon and the Northern Front. As we write this, and we saw it even throughout the course of today, more rockets and drones and missiles being fired by Hezbollah at Israel, even more than from Gaza these days. Hezbollah has forced the evacuation of almost 100,000 Israelis from the northern border region, which is unheard of, I think, in Israeli history. And there's a growing public pressure on the government, Netanyahu's government, as if it wasn't enough, to act decisively and eliminate the Hezbollah threat from southern Lebanon, combined with American pressure from the very first days of the war not to widen and escalate the overall situation. So it's not an easy question, but I have to ask it. What do you think will happen? Can the issue of the Israel-Lebanon frontier, you know, the issue of Hezbollah on the border, be resolved diplomatically? Or is a confrontation, a real confrontation, more than what we've seen now over the past 2.5 months, with Hezbollah inevitable?
So this is another strategic mess we've gotten ourselves into in recent months. And again, this was initiated by Hezbollah, of course, launching attacks along the border a day after the war in Gaza started. Now, as we now know, it's quite clear that Hassan Nasrallah had no idea of Yahya Sinwar's plans. They may have discussed that in the past, but he didn't know that Sinwar was about to initiate an attack at that specific date. It wasn't coordinated in advance. Maybe that was the reason why Sinwar was able to keep that as a secret and surprise us in such a devastating way. And what Nasrallah and Iran did is to pay lip service in a way to the Palestinian cause without getting themselves entangled in a regional war. But that was, again, that was enough to create havoc all over the border. And because of the those terrible videos from the south, people living in the north under similar conditions, the IDF recommended that they leave, and most of the residents left. Now, the destruction is not nothing of the kind of what we've experienced in the south, but yet hundreds and hundreds of rockets and anti-tank missiles were launched at Israeli kibbutzim and moshavim, the little villages around the border. So this is, you know, this is extremely problematic. And as you mentioned, we have refugees for the first time in Israeli history. We have, I think it's around 150 or 160,000 refugees from the north and the south. And there's no end in sight for this. So this is extremely problematic for the government. The Americans, President Biden's statement at that the middle of that terrible week in October, his full support of Israel was very, very important. But on the other hand, this don't message was not only meant for Hezbollah and Iran, but also for Israel. And Israel has refrained from a massive action. In the end, there were 12, by now there are 12 Israelis who died, most of them soldiers, in those incidents along the border, while about 115 Hezbollah fighters already killed, and some 30 or more Palestinian terrorists and Lebanese civilians were killed as well. So the sheer numbers, Israel has the lead, if you want to phrase it this way. But Israel hasn't solved anything. It showed that it has the upper hand while fighting Hezbollah along the border, but there's no solution there. And how do you persuade people who left that history could not repeat itself on the Lebanese border with a force which is much more experienced, has combat experience from the civil war in Syria, and is much better equipped than and trained than Hamas in Gaza? Now, what Israel is trying to push for is finally implementing 1701, which is the Security Council decision from the end of the war in 2006. And Hezbollah and Lebanon have never really respected that and have never acted accordingly. According to the decision, all Hezbollah forces should be kept north of the Litani border river, which is somewhere between 5 to 10 miles, it depends on the region, from the Israeli border.
Mm-hmm.
How does the U.S. manage to secure that? That's a very big question. According to Israeli generals and ministers, I've talked to quite a few senior generals, the chances are somewhere between 30 to 40% of America succeeding in this. But in any way, it will take time. And again, this don't message is remembered on both sides of the border. So I think that we could hopefully avoid a full-scale escalation now, but the problem remains, and it depends on the Americans trying to convince both sides of remapping the border and discussing the 13 areas of debates over the dispute over the where the actual border should be defined, and perhaps in return Hezbollah would evacuate. This doesn't seem to be a very plausible scenario. On the other hand, one could say, considering the devastation and destruction in Gaza, perhaps Nasrallah and his minders in Tehran are having second thoughts. If the Israelis are that crazy destroying Gaza, what will they do to Beirut or the Baca Valley, considering that there's much more of a threat to civilian population on our side? We'll have to see. It will take time, but yes, it's part of the problem. Again, if you look, Qasem Soleimani was assassinated by the Americans under Trump's orders in January 2020. And it was published then that Israel somehow helped behind the scenes. And it was seen then as a big success for the West, fighting Iranian terrorism and so on. And yet, almost 4 years later, the Soleimani vision of surrounding Israel by what he called a ring of fire, and he wasn't a Johnny Cash admirer or fan. This is quite successful.
Although we are.
Yeah, sure. Both of us. But we have better taste than Qasem Soleimani, I hope.
Than Qasem.
But if you think of this, Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, all kinds of Shiite militias in Iraq and Syria, and of course our new friends, the Houthis in Yemen, all of them are actually acting according to Soleimani's vision, and we're paying quite a price for this. Iran, in my view, should pay more, considering the damage that they're bringing to the region. But this is up to the Biden administration, and we'll see if they choose to engage with the Houthis to begin with, and with Iran next.
Absolutely, and on that note, Amos, we'll let you go. We do appreciate you taking the time during your very busy schedule to come and join us once again on the Israel Policy Pod. And we'll send our best wishes to you and the Harel family and all their friends out there serving. And we hope to have you on in future because, as you laid out for us, this is likely not going to end anytime soon. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks again to Amos Harel, as always, for his generous time and insights. Also, special thanks to our producer, Jacob Gilman, and to all of you who support Israel Policy Forum's work. 'Tis the season, as I say again, so with the end of year upon us, do consider making a donation to Israel Policy Forum so it can keep being a credible source of analysis and ideas on issues we all care deeply about, including this podcast. And most importantly, have a healthy and happy upcoming Christmas for all those celebrating, a healthy and happy upcoming New Year for all those celebrating, and of course, thank you for listening.